following is a live presentation of CITR News.
CITR 101.9 FM presents News 101, Vancouver's volunteer-produced student and community newscast. Now, here's your host, Rita Farkas.
Good evening. In the news this week, protests are rising over the construction of power lines in Tawasin, and controversy erupts in the House of Commons over environmental policy. We'll have all this, plus this week's weather forecast, coming up this half hour right here on News 101. A record crowd of 10,000 academics is expected to gather at UBC this week for the Congress of the Humanities and Social Sciences, an annual exchange of scholarly papers and ideas. Organizers are feeling optimistic this year as federal funding for the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada has been maintained. Earlier this year, a Senate committee recommended that the government recognize that social sciences are an integral component of scientific discovery. Conference attendees see this as a major victory, since the recommendation acknowledges that Canada's competitiveness cannot be built simply on the efforts of scientists and engineers. This year's organizers are hoping the size of the event and its big city location will draw media attention. To help, they have included several high-profile speakers on this year's agenda, including author and urban guru Richard Florida and ethicist Margaret Somerville. Now, with more local and provincial news, here is News 101 reporter Peter Otis.
UBC and the University of Hong Kong have established a new joint legal education program. The faculties of law at UBC and HKU will each accept up to 5 students per year, starting in 2009. All students enrolled in the program will be able to earn the law degrees required for law practice in both countries. The joint legal education program will add an extra year of study to the local requirements, making it 4 years for UBC students and 6 years for HKU students.
And TransLink announced today that all parts of the Lower Mainland Transit System, including buses, SkyTrain, West Coast Express, and SeaBus, are now fully accessible to people in wheelchairs and scooters. TransLink says the last hurdle was the retirement of older model trolley buses that had high floors and steps. The bus fleet has now been completely replaced by new trolleys with low floors, ramps, and more open floor space. One advocacy group for the disabled says it's a step in the right direction. But Margaret Birrell with the BC Coalition of People with Disabilities says more work needs to be done. She says the TransLink school should now do more driver training, staff training, and public awareness campaigns. Birrell also said that only 50% of the bus stops are currently accessible.
A protest against power lines may end up blocking a Tawasin ferry terminal next week. A Delta group is opposed to an overhead power line project, citing health concerns, and so they have announced that they may block the Tawasin ferry terminal sometime next week in order to draw attention to their cause. BC Ferries spokesperson Deborah Marshall says that while BC Ferries recognizes the right to protest, they will not hesitate to call the police if protesters show up at the ferry terminal because the terminal is private property. Police have been called in before during protests that didn't directly involve any BC Ferries actions. The protest group says it's also prepared to prevent construction workers from entering specific properties, citing concerns about migratory birds.
And depending how you look at it, Vancouver will be either suffering the loss or getting rid of a sculpture that's had people talking. The piece titled Device to Root Out Evil by New York artist David Oppenheim will be sent to Calgary's Glenbow Museum today. The sculpture is an upside-down church planted into the ground by its steeple. Its home since 2006 has been Vancouver's Harbour Green Park near Cole Harbour. The piece came to the city as part of the Vancouver Sculpture Biennial, a biannual celebration of public space and art. Some Vancouver residents interpreted it as a harsh criticism against religion. Others found it cheeky. And some thought it simply blocked the view. Vancouver's Public Parks Committee eventually voted to remove it. Glenbow Museum's president Jeff Spalding said it's now time for Calgarians to be inspired and challenged by the sculpture. The sculpture is owned by the Benefic Group, a company that promotes philanthropy in Canada. Benefic feels the move is a real loss for Vancouver, but a big win for Calgary. It's also a chance for the artist to be recognized in another Canadian city.
Select secondary schools in BC are losing out on substantial financial assistance this year, says the chair of the Vancouver Board of School Trustees, Ken Denick. Referring to the recently implemented no junk food policy introduced by the provincial government, Denick says the new policy has cut down one huge source of flexible funding schools have had for sports and music events. In some cases, the policy has meant that revenues are down by 50%. High sugar and high fat foods such as cookies, muffins, and fries have been banned since January in elementary schools. Middle and secondary schools will follow in September. Some secondary schools have already switched over their vending machines to offer milk, granola bars, and other healthier choices, Denick said. Connie Dinesic, president of the BC School Trustees Association, says it's too early to say how schools will be affected because many won't convert to the new rules until September. A few schools are actually reporting a small increase in revenue, she said. She also mentioned that parents and staff now have the opportunity to come up with alternative funding plans that don't include funding from junk food companies.
And it's now time for a quick break, but stay tuned to CITR for more news following these public service announcements.
Hi, I'm Kirsty.
And I'm Sheila.
And we're both single moms. We started SPOC UBC, Single Parenting on Campus, an AMS club, with the hope of drawing attention to the additional challenges single parenting students face on our campus. We want to create a space for single parenting students to find resources and support.
Our first meeting will be held on Tuesday, November 6th from 11 to 12:30 at the Women and Gender Studies, WAGS building right next to Brock Hall. We welcome all single parenting students and, of course, allies. And please remember that your children are always welcome.
Please help us spread the word by informing any single parenting students that you know about our group. We're also open to receiving anecdotes or stories from single parent students regarding their time spent at UBC.
Feel free to drop by our meeting on November 6th or send us an email at spoc.ubc@gmail.com. We really look forward to hearing or seeing you.
Come join the free evening gala talks of the 3rd Annual Wall Summer Institute for Research on June 23rd and June 25th. To reserve your tickets, call 604-822-1291. The Peter Wall Institute for Advanced Studies at UBC will bring together invited participants from around the world to explore the implications of a globalized capitalism for the future of agrarian society. On June 23rd from 6 to 7:30 at the Sheraton Wall Center, Jomo Kwame Sundaram from the United Nations will present Washington Rediscovers Agriculture, the Political Economy of the Agrarian Turn. And on June 25th from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the Freddie Wood Theater at UBC, Emmanuel Wallerstein from Yale University will speak on the return of the peasant. Possible? Desirable? Both of these events are free, but tickets must be reserved in advance by phoning 604-822-1291. Once again, that number is 604-822-1291. Come join the free evening gala talks of the 3rd Annual Wall Summer Institute for Research on June 23rd and June 25th. To reserve your tickets, call 604-822-1291. The Peter Wall Institute for Advanced Studies at UBC will bring together invited participants from around the world to explore the implications of a globalized capitalism for the future of agrarian society. On June 23rd from 6 to 7:30 at the Sheraton Wall Center, Jomo Kwame Sundaram from the United Nations will present Washington Rediscovers Agriculture, the Political Economy of the Agrarian Turn. And on June 25th from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the Freddie Wood Theater at UBC, Emmanuel Wallerstein from Yale University will speak on the return of the peasant. Possible? Desirable? Both of these events are free, but tickets must be reserved in advance by phoning 604-822-1291. Once again, that number is 604-822-1291.
This is News 101, and the current time is 5:15. Controversy has erupted between the provinces of Ontario and Quebec and the Canadian government. The two provinces have formally agreed to work together to cut greenhouse gas emissions, set up a high-speed train service, and further integrate their economies. In the first significant move in the new initiative, Premier Jean Charest and his Ontario counterpart, Dalton McGuinty, on Monday unveiled a cap-and-trade protocol for atmospheric carbon in Quebec City after holding their first joint provincial cabinet meeting. McGuinty said he would like to see a carbon trading program in place by 2010. Charest called tackling the issue of climate change a, quote, tremendous challenge for humanity. In their proposal, Ontario and Quebec offer a trading system that would put caps on greenhouse gas emissions. Big polluters that exceed those limits would have to buy credits from companies that come in under the cap, making it pay to go green. Charest pointed out their provinces are home to two-thirds of Canada's population and make up the fourth largest regional economy in North America, so it only makes sense for them to implement common strategies. With more on this story, here once again is Peter Otis.
Before the joint cabinet meeting, McGuinty said the federal government suffers from a lack of imagination, while Charest said the rest of the world is moving toward a similar cap-and-trade system, and he wants Canada to be at the forefront. But Federal Environment Minister John Baird said the talks between Charest and McGuinty are more about political posturing than cutting greenhouse gas emissions. He said it is just talk. Baird says the federal government has introduced aggressive intensity targets to make a 20% cut in greenhouse gas emissions from 2006 levels by 2020, and that the two premiers have been in government for 5 years and haven't done anything to force big polluters to reduce emissions. The bottom line is our numbers will be more aggressive and they'll be underway much sooner, said Baird. In the House of Commons today, Prime Minister Stephen Harper criticized the plan for not establishing a regulatory mechanism and suggested the new Montreal Climate Exchange will have to fill that void. Canada's first carbon trading market, a joint venture between Montreal Exchange and Chicago Climate Exchange, was launched last Friday.
And did you get out of bed okay this morning? A nationwide study of bunk bed-related injuries in the United States has found a surprising amount of injuries amongst college students. Researchers can't explain exactly what accounts for this spike in injuries amongst 18 to 21-year-olds, but they have a feeling it's rowdy dorm behavior to do with risk-taking and easy access to alcohol. College-aged individuals experience double the amount of injuries compared with their 14 to 17-year-old counterparts. College-age people make up 7% of all bunk bed-related injuries versus only 3.5% for younger teens. College students' injuries consist primarily of sprained ankles and broken legs. Study co-author Dr. Gary Smith of the Ohio State University College of Medicine says these injuries are anything but minor. It takes a long time to recover, and it's excruciatingly painful. And in international news, instead of political commentary this week with Phil Caudry, our producer Carrie Baptist is here with a story on the American War on Terrorism.
According to an article in the Guardian newspaper today, the British human rights organization Reprieve will soon be issuing a report which claims the United States has continued its practice of extraordinary rendition, holding suspects in the war on terror on, quote, floating prisons, and then attempting to conceal their whereabouts and the identities of these prisoners from the rest of the world. The group Reprieve urged the U.S. government yesterday to list the names and whereabouts of those detained. The information identifying these prison ships has come from a variety of sources, including statements by the U.S. military, the Council of Europe, and related parliamentary bodies, as well as from testimony by former prisoners. The report issued by Reprieve will also assert that since 2006, when the U.S. President George Bush claimed that there would be no more extraordinary renditions, since then there have been 200 new cases of extraordinary rendition. Extraordinary rendition is the capture and extrajudicial transfer of a person from one state to another. Some critics contend that the extraordinary rendition practiced by the U.S. was essentially torture by proxy, as the U.S. transferred suspects to Syria, Jordan, Morocco, and Egypt for interrogation, countries which are known to engage in torture. In the case of these prison ships, the United States seems to be taking extraordinary rendition prisoners aboard U.S. ships in international waters for interrogation, rather than transferring them into the hands of another government. According to the report by Reprieve, the U.S. may have used as many as 17 ships to hold prisoners since 2001, including the USS Bataan, the USS Ashland, and the USS Peleliu. Reprieve claims that the detainees are interrogated aboard the ships and then transferred to other undisclosed locations. Of particular concern to Reprieve are the activities of the USS Ashland when it was anchored off the coast of Somalia in early 2007. During that time, Reprieve claims that at least 100 people were apprehended by Somali, Kenyan, and Ethiopian forces, interrogated by CIA officials, and then sent to various prisons, with some being held on the USS Ashland. According to one account of a prisoner who had been interrogated on one of these prison ships, he and about 50 other men were held in cages on the bottom of the ship, quote, like something you see on TV. According to the account, the men were beaten aboard that ship more severely than at Guantanamo Bay. U.S. Navy spokesperson Commander Jeffrey Gordon says that there are no detention facilities on U.S. ships. However, he says it's on public record that some prisoners have been put on ships for a few days during their initial days of detention. He declined to comment on reports that U.S. naval vessels stationed in or near Diego Garcia, a British territory in the Indian Ocean, had been used as prison ships. The legal director of Reprieve, Clive Stafford Smith, says that by the U.S. government's own estimates, 26,000 people are currently being detained without trial. Since 2001, 80,000 people have gone through this system. In comparison, there are currently 12,000 people in federal prison in Canada.
And thank you, Carrie, for that very compelling piece. It's time now for another break, but when we come back, we'll hear from meteorologist Selena Ferris and a look at this week's weather forecast. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
If you look into a book, you might just say, I had fun just like Run, DMC and Jay.
Flash your Friends of CITR card and get discounts at Lucky's Comics, RX Comics, Magpie Magazine, People's Co-op Bookstore, and Spartacus Books. Support CITR and pick up your card today.
It's that time of year again. Music Waste, Vancouver's premier underground music festival, taking place June 5th to 8th at a number of venues, including the Astoria, Pub 340, and Hoko's. Music Waste will try and fit as many acts onto Vancouver stages as possible. Originally created in 1994 as a middle finger to the corporate music festival agenda, the four-day fest has become the premier outlet for up-and-coming Vancouver area artists, looking to steer clear of the musical norm in its all dull and predictable glory.
Likewise, it's where festival goers experience something out of the ordinary, with unorthodox rock acts such as Bison, Basketball, Modern Creatures, and Mutators all gearing up for this year's event. And with Music Waste boasting some 50-plus bands and passes going for a seriously cheap fee, it's a festival that truly sticks to its anti-profit stance. That's Music Waste, taking place June 5th to 8th, brought to you by Only Magazine and CITR 101.9 FM.
The May issue of The Scorner magazine is on the streets now. This month's issue features 20 questions with Hoxley Workman, interviews with Adeline and Krista Couture, a profile on the top bands playing this year's New Music West Showcase, and a song-by-song analysis by the Hawaiian Bibles. As always, Discorder features reviews of the hottest shows and albums, plus the datebook calendar and the CITR program guide. Discorder, that magazine from CITR 101.9 FM. Available anywhere in Vancouver that's remotely cool.
Welcome back to News 101 in the summer. I'm Rita Farkas, coming to you live from the Student Union Building at UBC. Thanks for being with us tonight. In international news, the Great Lakes Compact is gaining support between U.S. states and a few Canadian provinces. With more on that, FSRN brings us a report.
Early last week, Wisconsin became the fifth U.S. state to ratify the Great Lakes Compact, a proposed international agreement between eight states and two Canadian provinces that would protect North America's most important freshwater supply. Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Michigan still have to approve the compact before it goes to the U.S. Congress for ratification. The most recent roadblock is Ohio. Political infighting in the state's legislature is blocking the Natural Resources Protection Deal from passing. WORT's Chris Evans and Molly Stintz have more about the compact.
The Great Lakes Compact allows governors to veto any plan to divert Great Lakes water to other regions of the country unless all of the governors in the region agree. It provides the states an important share in the control of this vital resource. Peter Annan, journalist and author of The Great Lakes Water Wars, explains the significance of this compact.
The fact of the matter is that the Great Lakes region, the North American continent, and the entire world are all entering a period of increased water tension. Those tensions are primarily driven by water scarcity. And one of the largest reservoirs of fresh surface water on Earth is right here in the Great Lakes region. And legal scholars throughout the region and beyond feel that the current legal mechanisms that are set up to protect the waters of the Great Lakes from unwarranted large-scale long-range or short-range diversions has been inadequate.
Some environmentalists warn that global climate change and rising temperatures may threaten the U.S. water supply, causing loss of mountain snowpack to feed lakes and rivers, continued evaporation of reservoirs, and increased demands from the agricultural sector. Others say it has increased demand from arid states with fast-growing populations such as Nevada that are the real threat to the Great Lakes. Nevada Assemblyman Jack Hogan disagrees. He says that while his state is the driest in the country, they have never considered any plan to tap the Great Lakes water.
In several years of involvement in this issue, I had not even heard that mentioned until someone from the Water Authority threw it into the conversation. It was mentioned as, you know, a place where they may have more water than they need, and there might be a way to bring it over. That's probably about all we know about it.
Peter Annan argues that while the cost of transporting water across the country is prohibitive now, this may not always be the case.
You have people saying, yeah, but the economic value of clean, fresh water is skyrocketing, and that it's only a matter of economics, and that sooner or later the scales will tip in the opposite direction. It will actually make economic sense to ship Great Lakes water to far-flung venues.
Once all of the Great Lakes states have passed the compact, it must go to the United States Congress for approval before it can become law. Federal approval is not required in Canada. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, this is Chris Evans with Molly Stentz in Madison, Wisconsin.
And thanks as always to FSRN for their piece. Right now, it's 5:28 and time to turn things over to Selena Ferris for a look at this week's weather forecast. Selena?
It's going to be a cool and damp week with a frontal system moving in over the area. The rain will begin overnight and turn to showers by tomorrow with a high of 15. Wednesday, we'll see a break from the rain with the occasional scattered shower and a high of 17 and a low down to 10. Thursday and Friday will be much the same with a 60% chance of showers both days. That's your five-day weather brought to you by the Storm Club at UBC. For more information, you can email us at stormubc@gmail.com.
And thanks, as always, Selena. That's our program for Monday, June 2nd, 2008. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts, and if you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. Cary Baptist produced this radio program. For more news, join us next Monday at 5 p.m. for the next edition of News 101. The entire news team here at CITR, this is Rita Farkas thanking you for listening. Stay tuned for Career Fast Tracks coming up next on 101.9 FM CITR.